What are the other points about real estate being superior?
All right, well, that was question number two. Question number three goes as follows. The day you buy your $5,000 worth of stock for $5,000 cash and it's worth exactly $5,000, what can you personally do to increase the value of that stock portfolio?
Not much.
Well, not much. We can hope, we can pray, we could write letters to the directors of the company wishing them well, or we could perhaps buy as many of the products and services as those companies are offering to try and boost their bottom line. Your options are limited.
The thing I don't like about many stocks, as we're finding out with this Enron and the accounting issue and all this, is that the average shareholder has no power. They have no control. If the chairman of the board wants to sell and tell you to buy, you can't really do much. It's not really illegal. If they want to buy a new Learjet, you can't say anything. If they want to buy a new limousine and give everybody raises as a stockholder, you really don't have much say in that.
That's right. And that's why, in my personal humble view, buying stocks is a bit of a gamble. You are gambling that the directors aren't going to do silly things.
And what we're finding out in the stock market lately, there's a lot of people who run major corporations who have high-powered degrees from famous business schools. They may be well-educated, but they're not trustworthy.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons I personally don't take much of the advice I hear about, you know, from the analysts and things like this, is because you still really have no control over the management of the property or the business. So what's
anyway,
the next
let's
point?
Compare that with real estate. The day you buy your $50,000 property using $5,000 cash and a $45,000 mortgage, what can you personally do to increase the value of that property?
A lot.
A lot, right? There's an unlimited number of things you can do. You can paint it. You can pull down an old fence. You can put up a nice white picket fence. Change the carpet. Put in brighter light bulbs. So anyway, that's question number three. You can do many, many things to a piece of real estate to dramatically increase its value. The fourth and final question goes as follows. Let's assume everything's doubled in value. Your stocks have gone from $5,000 to $10,000. What do you have to do in order to get some of the benefit of that increase in value?
Generally, you have to sell it.
You have to sell either a part of the portfolio or all of it. Either way, it doesn't matter. In my mind, that's going counterintuitively. You're doing the very thing you don't want to do. You want that portfolio to grow.
You're diminishing your portfolio by selling assets on it.
Right. And let's compare that with real estate. Your $50,000 property has doubled in value from $50,000 to $100,000. What do you personally have to do to get some of the benefit of that increase in value? Well, without doing anything, Robert, you're already getting a benefit of the increase in value because your rentals will now reflect a $100,000 property rather than a $50,000 property. But apart from that, when we look at the capital involved, you've created $50,000 out of thin air. You do not have to sell that property to get that $50,000.
Again, the banks are willing to lend you the money.
Right. You simply get a new appraisal, go back to the bank, and they will be lining up saying, hey, we hear your property's gone to $100,000. May we please give you some extra cash?
That's right.
Anyway, they are big differences, and what I want to address is why so many people invest the great proportion of their net worth in the stock market rather than the real estate market in face of these four, what I think are pretty powerful questions.
So, Dolph, let's go into my Rich Dad's six steps on how you find a piece of property, regardless of where you are throughout the world. Step number one is decide to learn to become an investor. So let me ask you this question. When you started at 17, did you learn something on that transaction?
Oh, totally. I probably learned the most of any transactions on that first one. I learned what it felt like to sign my name to a contract where the net worth was not just much larger than my net worth. It had net worth and I didn't.
Right.
I was trembling at the time.
Have you learned more as each transaction goes on?
With every deal.
You learn something new.
You learn something new. In fact, when I'm not learning, I know I'm not doing enough.
Right. And I talked about the knee-knocking factor and all this.
Right.
Do you oftentimes feel the same nervousness that you did when you were 17?
I do, but I have to add that now I almost like that feeling. It's that feeling of you're about to do something dramatic. It's a bit like when you jump out of an aeroplane with a parachute on or you do a bungee jump. It's that same fear factor. You know in all probability things are going to be good, but there's an element of excitement too.
So that's a big point. Not only are you learning about property, you're learning about yourself.
Right.
And that's what I have to say to a lot of people is that for me, that nervousness that people run away from is really the excitement. It's like Monopoly, but it's Monopoly in real life. It makes it, you know, tingling. I mean, not all deals go well, do they?
Not all deals go well. Not all of mine have gone well. But, you know, the other thing is that real estate is extremely forgiving of mistakes. If you make a mistake, you bought in the wrong area or whatever, give it enough time and that mistake will be corrected automatically.
Right. Step two on this program is find an area. The first step we look at is an area. Is it going up or down?
Right.
And on this program, we've covered three basic areas. One that's pretty stable, one that's going down, and one that's been down and about to come up. And we also looked at properties approximately of the same price range.
Right.
So when you go into an area, what are you looking for?
Well, exactly that. I need to know which area is likely to go up. And the reason for that is if you just look for a great deal, you might find a house where you can do a few things to it to increase the value, and it might look good. But if it's in an area that's going down, you're cutting yourself short. And the fact of the matter is it is so easy to find an area that is going up. You don't need to do 3 months of intensive study. You can make 3 phone calls, phone a few brokers, appraisers, agents, and find out which areas are up and coming. And in doing so, you know that in all probability, you're going to beat the average for that city.
Right. You know, you may have gone to different cities throughout the world, and we walk into a real estate office or restaurant. It doesn't make any difference. People know, see, this area is going bad, this area is going good.
Right.
People know, and we get our information from the people in the area.
And not only do they know, they are willing to share. In fact, when we found that little white dumpling house, we were actually looking at one across the road from there. And while we were looking at that, a neighbor came up to you with a sheet of paper saying, well, you know, this house is also for sale, and started telling you about it. And then on the other side, a couple were renovating their house, telling you everything that was right and wrong about the area, what was right and wrong about the house. People want to share this information. All you need to do is engage them in conversation.
Right. So the most important part of the area is the area improves in value, not the house. So when people are looking for a fixer-upper, the thing I always say to them is, you know, a piece of wood, a 2x4x8 feet, mm-hmm. costs the same amount of money. You know, if you put that same 2x4x8, let's say it costs you $3.
Right.
If you put it in an area that's moving up, that 2x4 goes up in value. You put that 2x4 in areas going down, that 2x4 goes down in value.
That's a great point.
But the price remains the same.
Right.
So I'm not looking for a fixer-upper. I'm looking for an area. Then if there's a fixer-upper, you know, hopefully we found an area where it's going to go up, because labor, paint, wood, concrete, all cost the same.
Right.
It's the area that lifts it.
Right. Now, that's a great point. And that's why the first thing I will do is find out which part of this town or city is moving and which isn't.
So step 3, which comes up to, is how do you identify a potential property? So that's a lot of times by driving around, asking questions.
Right.
But also is that we have an analysis program, because it allows you to see the numbers that the investor wants to see.
Right.
And you use numbers more than paint to analyze a good deal.
Yes. I'll use paint to renovate, but to analyze it, I need to know the numbers. And very often, a property can appear good, whereas in actual fact, the returns might be relatively low. But more importantly, a property might appear not very good, but when you analyze the numbers, you say, wow, can you believe it? This is a great performer. And you cannot do that by working out the numbers in your head.
And the reason for that is because there's too many variables.
Too many variables. Robert, when you put $100,000 in the bank and you're getting $6,000 return per annum, your yield, your return is roughly 6%.
It takes no intelligence to save
money. Intelligence. Some people would need a calculator for it, but most people can work that out in their heads. However, when you buy a piece of real estate for $100,000 and the rental income is $6,000 per year, then by definition, the return or the yield is indeed 6%, but it does not tell us how well our money is performing, because firstly, even though the property costs $100,000 to buy, we're not necessarily putting up $100,000. We might only have $10,000 in the deal.
So the variables could be interest rate?
Interest rate.
Down payment?
Down payment.
So if I could reiterate that once you find an area, you look around, you start looking at properties, leave your checkbook at home. You don't have to make offers. You don't need any money, because real estate moves so slowly. It's not this frenetic buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell. Sometimes in real estate, we've actually seen people line up and they're bidding the price of a property up. If that's happening, as a serious investor, you'd probably back away, because you're probably too late anyway, right?
Right, just stay away from those deals.
Yeah, so you leave your checkbook at home. You don't need money to go look around and go shopping. You don't need to disturb the tenants. You don't need to disturb a broker, but do your research on the area. Then step three is how you identify a property. And this is where different brokers or different sales agents have different categories, and as why, as an investor, you want to make sure you're talking to a real estate agent who is also an investor. For example, if I'm a homeowner, I want to see, you know, how pretty is the paint, how are the flower beds, is the kitchen good, how many bedrooms and all this. But investors at this point are not necessarily interested in the paint or the flower beds. They're now more interested in the deal. And the question comes up then is, how do you analyze a property? Because analyzing a piece of real estate, step 3, is not the same as a saver who just goes to a bank and puts, let's say, $10,000 in the bank at 6%. It's a little bit more complex than 6% off of $10,000.
Right. When you put $10,000 in the bank and you're getting $600 a year coming in, it's pretty easy to work out what your returns are.
Yeah, you know, it's not a rocket science. Being a saver doesn't require much financial intelligence.
Right. However, if you use that same $10,000 as a down payment on a property that costs $100,000 and your rental income is $6,000 a year, then by definition, it may well be true that the returns are 6%, $6,000 coming out, you bought the property for $100,000.
But there's too many more variables to real estate.
Right. It doesn't tell us whether that's a good deal or not.
So the point I want to make right now before Dolph gets into the analysis part, in this workbook, in the Time Life product, there are worksheets that will show you some of these variables that an investor will go through to analyze a piece of property to identify the right investment for you.
Right. And some of those variables that we have to think of are, firstly, what's the interest rate on the loan that you have to pay?
That's a big difference between a 6% interest and a 12% interest rate.
Sure. Or another way of framing that question would be, does it matter whether it's 6% or 12%? Because there are other variables where the difference may not matter. And what's the application fee for getting the mortgage? And do you need the property appraised in the first place? And if so, how much does that cost? And does that affect your investment at all? What are the property taxes on the property? What do we think the maintenance is going to be? If it's a new building, it's probably going to have lower maintenance than if it's really old.
What's a vacancy factor?
Vacancy factor, very important. What sort of homeowners association fees do we have on this property? Is there any pest control that needs doing? All these things either increase or decrease your cash flow. One of the biggest factors, Robert, is depreciation. This is an expense that you can deduct against your income, even though it doesn't cost you a cent. Very important. Now, if you don't figure these things out, you will not know whether it's a good deal or not. Because the interesting thing is sometimes an investment will look good, but when you actually do the analysis, you realize that it's not such a good investment. But more importantly, oftentimes an investment property won't look very good at all, but when you do the analysis, suddenly you realize that, hey, this thing's a great performer.
Again, what Dolph is saying here, this is the nuts and bolts. This is the make or break point of the investment property. It's not the pretty house or the roof or anything like this. It has to do with the numbers. Again, in the workbook, you will find the worksheets that will give you some indication of it. If you don't understand it all at one time, please do not worry. You know, Dolph and I started off as beginners a long time ago, as some of you may be starting off as a beginner. So start as a beginner, but as you do it more and more and more, as I said, the process makes you smarter, because today it's the numbers that make you rich. Isn't that true?
It is the numbers that make you rich. To the point, Robert, that very often I used to start off going out looking at real estate deals, and then when I found a few that I thought might be good, I'd analyze them. Now what I prefer to do is analyze the deals that come across my desk, and if there are any that look as though they're good investments, I will then and only then go out and look at them.
That's correct. How long does it take you to analyze a property now that you've done it thousands of times?
I can do it in about 40 seconds flat.
Right. And that's where you find whether it's good investment, bad investment. So in this real estate investment program, you will find worksheets. Take your time, study it, look at it, try a few numbers. But always remember that Dolph and I started off as beginners. The experience builds, to the point where you become fairly sophisticated at it. So in this program, go to the worksheets, take your time. It's a very important part of becoming a real estate investor, is how to identify a good property from a bad property. It's nothing to do with the paint. Oftentimes has to do with the numbers or things you cannot see. For example, Dolph mentioned this depreciation. Most people think depreciation sounds bad because it's kind of an expense in some ways. But in reality, to a sophisticated investor, depreciation is wonderful, simply because that's how you make extra money. For example, on this one investment Kim and I have done, we make 15% cash-on-cash return, but we also make another 30% through depreciation, which ups our return to 45%. And we get that month in, month out, month in, month out. So understanding how you analyze a property, understanding where the numbers fit, is where much of the money is made. Would you agree with that, Dolph?
I totally agree with that. And very often it appears as though depreciation is something that only occurs when the value of the asset goes down. For most assets, that's true, cars or computers or whatever. The beauty of real estate is that you can still claim depreciation, even though the value of the property is going up.
So before leaving step three, which is identifying potential properties, I'd like to strongly recommend, once again, that people leave their checkbooks at home, go look at some properties, use the worksheets found in this real estate investment program, and start using the different variables and inputs into the worksheet that'll affect the value of your money and the ultimate value of your investment. Having some practice at this allows you to be better at step four, which is negotiating and making an offer, because a lot of the offer, not all of it, comes from the numbers you've run in the analysis program. Is that correct, Dolph?
That's right. The numbers tell you what that property is worth to you. So you might figure out that you want to pay X dollars for it, but more particularly, there might be some aspect of the property that tips you off that you can afford to pay a bit more for it. As we said before, you might ask more than the offer price, so long as you can get a commensurate benefit somewhere else.
Right. Sometimes I'll offer more if we'll get our terms, because if you can get this thing for nothing down, let's say it's $100,000, but you offer them $110,000, but nothing down, your return is staggering.
Right, it goes through the roof.
Hmm. Yeah, and that variable might be rent. Can the rental from this property carry a $110,000, basically nothing down investment? At that point, you're smarter, better able to structure your deal. And as I said, anybody can lowball. That takes no intelligence. But step three gives you the financial intelligence to be more articulate, more sophisticated, and see returns that the average investor cannot see.
Right.
So going on to step four, what is your process from here? Now that you've done your numbers, you've done your analysis, and you see a pretty good deal sitting there, the negotiation and offer process begins.
To me, this is the really exciting bit, because with real estate, you can put anything in your offer that you want. When it comes to just about any other transaction, stocks, bonds, treasury bills, certificates of deposit, you can't structure an offer on your terms. If the CD is selling at, you know, $68,000, that's what you have to pay. Whereas with real estate, you can add other things and just some wacky ideas. There's nothing to stop you putting in your offer document, for instance. The seller will accept as part payment for this acquisition my old BMW that's only firing on three cylinders. It may sound odd, but the point is you can put things like that in the deal, and people often do. So this is your chance to be creative. Most people will come up with a pretty standard offer where they're offering a certain price and they might want some carryback finance at a certain interest rate. But you can just about do anything you like in there. One of the examples I think is of most benefit to people is part of the offer could be that you agree that closing will not take place immediately, but may in fact take place 2 or 3 months out. And that furthermore, in your offer contract you put, the buyer will have the right of access in the meantime, prior to closing, to effect improvements. Now, there's no downside for the seller. He's absolutely got a rock-solid contract. You will close within 3 months. You will pay the asking price. And even if you go onto the property in the meantime to effect improvements, if you renege on the deal, he's got the benefit of those improvements. The advantage for you could be, for instance, that you're agreeing to buy this property for $100,000. That's the seller's asking price. But in the meantime, you go in there and put those petunias in and all those other minor improvements so that when you get round to closing, you bring the appraiser in and suddenly it appraises at $120,000. And then when you get an 80% mortgage, you might be able to acquire all of the acquisition price in the form of a mortgage.
So you put nothing down.
Again, there's nothing down with no seller finance required. In the final analysis, what makes it a good deal for you is whether the numbers work. You've got to know whether you've got the cash flow, which covers all your costs and then leaves some at the end, and whether there's good long-term growth in that area that we identified way in the beginning to make an investment worth your while. There are many factors that can make it an extra specially good deal. I always look for a property with a bit of a twist, something that I can effect a change that will dramatically improve the value of that property beyond what it's costing me.
So an example of a twist could be like a garage or a second house on the property.
Right. One of my favorite examples is when there is a house which has no garage or carport, you can very easily, and for around $1,000, build a carport there. The value of the property will go up a lot more than the $1,000 it would cost to build that carport. What's more, you will get easily $80 a month extra in rental income, which over the course of a year is about $1,000. So by spending $1,000 cash, you can get an extra $1,000 a year coming in. That's 100% return on your money, which of itself is pretty good.
In 1 year.
In 1 year, but you get that every year, and it's indexed for inflation.
And if you talk to the banker, you may ask for a higher appraisal.
Right, but it will be easy to get because the appraised value should in fact be higher with the carport there. Or if in fact there is already a carport there, you might even box it in and turn it into a garage. So the ideas are limited only by your imagination, and that's one of the things I love about real estate. When I look at a property, I mentally go through this checklist of all the things I can do to the property to increase its value, and what things can I put in the contract when I'm negotiating to buy it so that I can get the benefit of these improvements.
The other part about an offer I always put in is I always say, this is contingent upon my partner or somebody inspecting the property. That contingency is always my escape. So it gives me a chance to find out what the negotiation really is between the seller. So if they, in case they accept it right away, I still have an escape clause in there if I find something I don't want. Sometimes if I find something I don't want in my due diligence or my inspection process, that's another reason to go back to the seller and renegotiate. So as we say on the video, it costs you no money to make an offer. The point here is this: if you've gone through the steps, you've looked at enough properties, you know what the value is, you know what the rental rates are, your nervousness goes down, because this is where most people back out, because it's like the big commitment time and they have to make an offer time. You still have escape routes if you just put an escape clause in it. But don't do that to escape. Do that to protect yourself more than anything else. But this is where the process gets real, and oftentimes amateur investors back out. Anything you want to say about that, Dolph?
I agree with that. I think if your offer is going to be rejected, it should be rejected by the seller and not by you, the offeror, before you've submitted it, because you've got one of these little voices inside your head saying, well, this won't work, or there's something wrong here.
Or there's too much risk, or what if this goes bad, or something like
this. And always remember that no matter how complex the deal is, the more complicated it gets, the tougher it is on your competition too. And all you need is a bit more perseverance than they've got, and you will get more deals than anyone else.
Right. So this is where the knee-knocking factor gets high for most people. But if you've done your numbers, you've done your research, that your confidence should be higher, even though your knees continue to knock. But keep going forward and make as many offers as possible, simply because, as Dolph says, don't reject yourself. Let the seller do that.
Right. And when some of those offers are accepted and you start to get that positive cash flow, and as time goes on, you see that those values have been rising, the only thing you'll say to yourself is not anything like, gee, my knees were knocking a lot, or I shouldn't have done this deal. You'll say, if only I'd bought more.
So moving on from step 4 to step 5, let's say you come to an agreement with the seller. You've made an offer, they may have countered, and you've gone back and forth. You've worked out the finer terms of the agreement. At this point comes a whole nother set of learning. The fifth step is putting the deal together.
And this is where you can often draw on some of your professional advisors. You might go to a finance broker or someone who can help structure the loan in a way that is suitable to yourself. If you're dealing with a commercial property, you might need some help in order to get a commercial lease document done. When you're doing your due diligence, you have to check existing leases and look for any clauses which might be onerous towards you.
Yeah, due diligence is extremely important on many levels, not only inspection of the property, but inspection of your finance, of the market conditions, of the rental agents, of the management. This is when the whole package starts coming together.
Right. And I always say that looking for the deal is always the exciting bit, and finding one that you think might have an angle for you, and then getting it to the point where they agree to the offer. The bits that come after that, what we're talking about now, the due diligence and structuring it, that can be a bit more tedious, and sometimes it feels a bit like cranking a handle. But it's equally important, because if you give up now, you'll lose the deal, or you'll use one of those out clauses to say, I don't think I want it anyway, and then you're back to square one.
Yes, and sometimes I've actually done my due diligence and I found the deal was not as advertised. Sometimes it's not as good.
But is it not also true that sometimes you thought a deal is going to be reasonably good, you do your due diligence, and then you find out that indeed it wasn't as it appeared, it's a lot better?
I have found that's a lot better more times than I have found it was not as good as advertised.
Right.
If you're dealing with a reputable seller, the deal is often better. If you're dealing with an unreputable seller, sometimes you'll find the hidden things that, you know, most people would say are bad. But if they are legitimately not as advertised, it gives you an opportunity to go back and say, let's renegotiate this, and it becomes an advantage again.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with saying something like, well, when I looked at it, I thought the situation was a certain way, and therefore we agreed on this figure. But now, when I realize that the land doesn't encompass all the land we saw, it's a lot less, for instance, suddenly it's worth a lot less to me. I'm still happy to buy it, but we need to adjust the acquisition price for me to truly reflect its value.
And some of the points that are put together in this deal, the escrow agent will tell you, so you don't really have to worry that much, or the bank will tell you. They may need an environmental study. They may need a new survey, or you need to talk to your management company as well whether they want to take this property over. So there's many parts of putting the deal together, and as Dolph says, it's actually kind of anticlimactic.
It is a little bit. And then the trickiest bit for a lot of people is getting the finance. And that is where traditionally we've been brought up thinking that applying for a mortgage is something that isn't very good. We almost feel bad about it. We feel as though we have to ask the bank for money. And the only thing I really want to say about getting mortgages is that even though we use the terminology that we get a mortgage from the bank, in actual fact, we're not getting anything from them. We're making them an offer. We're offering them an investment. They are going to invest in this piece of real estate with us. And if it's a great investment, they will willingly and gladly lend you money to do so. Remember, they far more readily lend money on real estate than anything else, as evidenced by the fact that the interest rates are lower.
So what Dolph is saying here is that the bankers need to lend money.
That's their business.
Yeah, so don't feel like they're doing you a favor. You're doing them a favor also.
Right. And as I often say, always remember that when you owe the bank $5,000, you've got a problem. But when you owe the bank $5 million, they've got a problem, and they look after you very well.
That's right. The other part of putting the package together is I always ask for a professional home inspection or a building inspector to go into it. If there's need of repair at that moment, if it's a fixer-upper, at this point I'll bring in a licensed general contractor to start giving me some bids, because I need to get some real numbers now as to how good or bad my estimates were up to this point. So this is a part where it's almost all common sense. If you don't ask the questions, for instance, have you checked the environmental, the banker will ask you for that. If you haven't had a home inspection, the escrow agent or the bank will ask for that. These are all parts where it comes together. It is a little bit tedious, but it's a very important part of the deal.
It is, and it's important for two reasons. Firstly, for instance, the environmental inspection. We don't just want that done so that we can appease the bank manager when he says, have you had an environmental inspection? If, in fact, it used to be a toxic dump site, you want to know that before you buy it.
Right, or it has asbestos in the building. You want to know before you buy it.
Right.
So most of these due diligence phase inspections are to protect you more than anybody else, because if you don't check it, it's really hard for you to sell it to the next person if you sell it.
Right. And of course, it does cost money to get these inspections and reports produced. However, you can deduct that against your income.
It's just part of the expense of putting an investment together.
Right.
And this putting the deal together, the due diligence phase, is vital, because that'll affect how well you can sell the property in case something is wrong. In most cases, there's nothing wrong. It goes pretty smoothly, but it's still a very important part of the process because it does protect you. So rather than get into the detail on what due diligence means, inside the real estate investment program, you will find a due diligence checklist via which you can go through. You may want to add to it, subtract from it, or talk to advisors like an attorney or a real estate appraiser to say you should add these things to it.
Right.
But always use a checklist.
Because not all items on that checklist will apply to every property. So you want to have a checklist that is all-encompassing so that no matter what the property is, you've covered all your bases.
And if you want more information, oftentimes a person to go ask is an escrow agent or even a banker, because they're the ones who ultimately own the property. And the banker will definitely give you a good due diligence checklist. So it's a very important part, but I strongly advise people to look at it as an opportunity to discover the good, the bad, and the ugly about the property, and at that point, you can make a decision one more time. If anything changes, rerun your numbers again. Double check again in the analysis, because now you're going live. Now these numbers become for real. They're not estimates. They're now as real as possible. So at this point, before signing and agreeing to take the property, run your numbers one more time. So we're ready to move from step 5 to step 6. Step 6 is a vitally important step, and that's called property management. I strongly suggest this. If you're just starting out, manage your property yourself. Start with a small deal and start practicing your own management, because that's the only way you learn. You learn from the front line, from real life, from real-time experiences. It is one of the most valuable learning experiences a person can go through, because if you don't know how to manage your property, you don't know a good property manager from a bad one. So what Kim did was she spent about 3 years managing her own property to the point where she felt comfortable in turning over the management to a property management company. So that experience, that learning of management, was vital. If you're not willing to do that, I wouldn't recommend getting into real estate investing, because management after the purchase is vital, because a property manager is now responsible for the collection of rent, the selection of tenants, the increasing of value, the protection of value, and the overall well-being of your asset. So at this point, the more you know about management, the better you will be at selecting a property management person or a company. Any comments on that, Dalton?
I fully agree. I strongly encourage people to do their own management for quite a while, because it's only when you start to manage your own properties that you realize what's involved. Otherwise, we all might know philosophically that ultimately we don't want to manage our own properties. You might even be forward-thinking enough to realize that you shouldn't be managing your own properties, because it's going to eat into the time that you could spend looking for new deals. However, you should always manage your first property so that you know what's involved. Know what sort of issues come up for property management people, so that when you get to hire your managers, you know exactly what you should be looking for, and you can tell a good manager from a not so good one.
So this goes full circle back to step one, is decide to become an investor, decide to be an active learner, and learn all six steps. And so management is a very important step to learn, because again, it goes back to the numbers. Now you're going real time. Now you're going real numbers. If you find a manager who's saying, I'm saving money for you, you know, by cutting down expenses, well, they may not be doing repairs. And just because they're saving you money in expenses and not doing repairs, they're actually damaging your property by not what's called deferred maintenance in the jargon or the parlance of the industry. It is a very important part of the process to learn. That's step six. So I'll reiterate again, all six steps are important. All six steps require different skills, different things to learn, different technologies to learn. If one step is left out, for instance, management, the whole thing can be the biggest nightmare. So the people I hear the most complaints about real estate are people who tried real estate but lost at it. And the reason they lost at it is often because one of the steps was missing, or two of the steps was missing. And today they'll tell you, oh, real estate is terrible, don't invest in it, you'll lose money and all this. But generally, if you really inspect and ask them what happened, you'll find that one or two of the six steps was missing.
I fully agree with that.
So in summary, these are the six important steps of becoming a professional real estate investor. I still think step one's the most important. You got to be a lifelong learner, because every day you learn something new. As this program goes along, we'll be going into greater detail on certain aspects of these six steps. But all six steps are important. Dolph, your summary.
My summary is that the deal of the decade truly comes along about once a week. If you don't believe that, then you'll hear of someone doing a great deal and you'll wait another 9-point-something years before you'll even start looking. If you do believe that the deal of the decade comes along about once a week, you will keep your eyes open and you will be out there and you will be astounded at what you find. The other point I want to make, I just want to reiterate it, the tougher the deal, the less your competition. So the more moving parts there are that make some people nervous and scared, the less competition there'll be to pursue that deal, and you'll find that you're just dealing with one or two competitors. That's a much easier situation to deal with than in other investments where there are thousands of people trying to do the same deal.
That's correct. So in closing, I'd like to say this. If you hear somebody who is bad-mouthing real estate, they very often don't own any investment real estate, or there are people who are losers at investment real estate. So if you're going to be successful at this, find people who are successful, learn these six steps, and you too will find that owning real estate is probably one of the best investments you'll ever make.